Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who? Star Wars or Doctor Who?
His name is Rob.
His name is Rob.
He knows his Wookiees from his Daleks. Listen now.
Listen now.
Hear the Force challenge the TARDIS. Get your blue milk and jelly babies while we see which drives you crazy. Star Wars or Doctor Who.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who. I'm your host, Rob Irwin, and isn't driving to work a good time to just sit and think? This week I was thinking about the podcast on my drive to work and how I said in an early episode that I didn't know if it was brave or crazy or maybe even both to try and mash Star Wars and Doctor Who together in a podcast. But my gut was telling me that I love both and I can't be the only person out there who does. And of course, since I've said that, I've seen plenty of people come out of the woodwork and say that they do as well, and the hits on our show feed are punching well above their weight, as I've said in the past, and beyond all expectations that, you know, I could have ever had, really. So that got me thinking as I was driving to work this week, what if I'd decided to do a Star Wars and Walking Dead show, or a Game of Thrones and Doctor Who show, and all sorts of crazy variations like that. And you know, as strange as Who Wars is as a concept, and I know it doesn't work for everyone, none of the other options, you know, in air quotes, worked at all to my mind. And then the thought arrived in my mind, lightly at first and then with a bit more impact as I was driving along. Star Wars and Doctor Who are both science fantasy. Of course, they're still two quite different IPs, and naturally people all over the world still call them science fiction, and truly believe that they're science fiction every day of the week. But they're actually science fantasy to my mind, and I think that's why they might appeal equally to so many people out there, and why, somewhere in the depths of my mind, subconsciously at least, I strode ahead and mashed them up in this podcast. Anyway, that's just a little musing I had earlier in the week, and I thought it might be fun to mention here. I've actually tweaked our description on Twitter to reflect as much and really hammer home that these are two great science fantasies that we're covering here. What do you think? Write in and let me know. Anyway, moving on. I talked about two great podcasts last week, and I said I might start doing it as a bit of a thing. So let's talk about another two. For the Doctor Who fans out there, you really can't go past Diddly Dum. I can't say enough nice things about these guys. It's three guys in the UK sitting down and having a conversation about Doctor Who. Obviously, when we're in the middle of a series, they'll be talking about, you know, current episodes and whatnot, but when the show's not on, they talk about many other topics besides. And you have here, I think, the successful formula for many podcasts, which is three distinctive personalities. You can really latch on to who each of them are. They have different accents, they have different thoughts on things, they present differently, and you can really get this nice feel that, the Binro was right, people actually describe them as a family, like a mummy bear, a papa bear, and a baby bear. I might not go quite that far, but it does give you the sense of what it's like. You know, if you like humor and presentation that's a little off the wall, a little bonkers, a little Python maybe, then this is probably the podcast for you. Also, if you're a Whovian who is across both the classic and modern eras of Doctor Who, I think that would really help, as the three guys are knowledgeable across the lot and do crossover across both the classic series and the newer stuff. So that's Diddly Dum. Meanwhile, for the Star Wars fans, I can't go past This Isn't the Pod. Now, this is a Australian comedian, a Melbourne-based comedian called Steele Saunders, who I've had the pleasure of chatting to by email and Twitter and on Facebook and through the post and stuff. He's a really, really nice guy. And he does something. He already had a podcast, I've got to say, before he put out This Isn't the Pod, called I Love Green Guide Letters. The Green Guide is basically a pullout in a Melbourne newspaper, which has, the TV listings and stories, and, you know, people can write in and say what they thought about the week in TV. And he'll often read out the letters to the Green Guide in a funny voice and have guests on the show to comment and, you know, mess around with him. And being a comedian, he has a lot of comedian friends. And I always love comedians getting together and not doing their shtick, not doing their spiel or their latest show, but actually just chatting together. I love to overhear that kind of stuff. And it does pop up in different podcasts here and there. And it does in I Love Green Guide Letters. And it also does to a large degree in This Isn't the Podcast. Now, I'm not saying Steele talks to a comedian every week, but the majority of his guests to date on This Isn't the Pod have been comedians. And basically, Steele sits down and talks to people for an hour or so on Star Wars. It gets a bit sweary. It gets a bit rude here and there. Depends on who the guest is, really. But it's such a different take on Star Wars that it's really entertaining. Also, being an Australian podcast, there are things I can relate to. Steele's a few years younger than me, but generally we've had the same upbringing, so I can sort of see where he's coming from on things. His first Star Wars at the cinema was Return of the Jedi, mine was Empire Strikes Back. So there's sort of that, you know, small age difference, but it's just enough that I don't always agree with what he says, like that Ewoks are good and that Return of the Jedi is the best of the classic trilogy, but overall, This Isn't the Pod is a lot of fun. Do check both of these podcasts out. I'll put links to them in the show notes. You know, later on this week, I saw an article on DoctorWhoNews.net, which basically said the Doctor Who writer Neil Gaiman, well, he's more than a Doctor Who writer, but I guess in this context he is a Doctor Who writer. Neil has indicated that recruiting women writers for Doctor Who is a priority for the people working on the show, and that the script editors and producers whom he's worked with on a direct basis, most of them women, have been giving much attention to bringing aboard more female writers. So there's an interesting point right there that I don't think a lot of people might realise, that many of the script editors and producers, people behind the scenes on Doctor Who, are women. There is this shortage of women writers on the series, and that's a very real thing. But there are a lot of women already working on the show in the background. Anyway, I'll go on. Posting on Tumblr in a response to a question from the user Lenny Berry, Gaiman said specifically, quote, "They've reached out to a lot of women writers. I know that Stephen Moffat has personally been in touch with a lot of female writers and been defeated over and over by scheduling problems and people saying no. It's a priority for them too." End quote. So I think this is a really, really interesting thing, because I know I bang on about people hating on Stephen Moffat in these little editorials before I do Who Wars each week. And one of the complaints you see time and time again, indeed I once saw a mega long blog post on a really well-known site, which basically came to the conclusion that Stephen Moffat didn't like women. And the proof for this, apparently, was that women weren't writing for Doctor Who. And I sat there and thought, you know, that's really not the Stephen Moffat that I know. Well, I don't know him personally, but from everything I've read and how I've seen him act and the company he keeps, I don't think he's that kind of guy. I think if someone came to Stephen Moffat with a great script, he would say, wow, that's a great script. And it wouldn't matter whether it was a man or a woman or an alien or whoever giving it to him. I really don't think he would pick a script based on the sex of the person who gave it to him. And yet that was the premise of this really long blog post on this really well-known site. I was kind of incredulous at that. Yes, there is an issue that there aren't enough women writing Doctor Who, but to say that it's because the showrunner doesn't like women, that's bizarre. So I jumped on Twitter and posted this story out there and said, you know what? People might not believe Stephen Moffat when he talks about this stuff, but surely they will believe Neil Gaiman. I mean, Neil Gaiman is such a defender of women's rights. I don't know if he identifies as a feminist, but I think he comes across certainly as one in everything he says and does with regard to women. Look at the woman he's married to, Amanda Palmer. You know, if Neil Gaiman is saying, look, Stephen's trying really hard, Stephen's out there, and it's really scheduling problems and people saying no to him that's the issue, I would believe Neil Gaiman any day over someone who I've never met writing a blog post and just making it up, basically, that Stephen Moffat doesn't like women. Just incredible. And, you know, if I can say one more thing on this topic, I think it's over time, I think we'll see more women writing for the show. And that's a product of more women coming into the industry, more women being Who fans. I mean, if you think back to the 70s and 80s, when people like Stephen Moffat and the other guys who are writing Doctor Who at the moment were fans, there were less women into Doctor Who in general. It might be hard to believe these days when you look around at fandom, and it seems that it's maybe not even a 50-50 split. It seems there may be even more women into Doctor Who than men. But back in the day, that wasn't the case. So as those people have grown up and come into TV production and learn to write TV and are now writing and running Doctor Who, I think it's only natural that there are more men in that mix, because if you go back, it's a no-brainer to see that more men were into Doctor Who back in the day. But now that Doctor Who has been on our screens for almost a decade, I think there are more women fans who are going to be coming up, moving into television, writing, and over time, you'll be seeing more of them filter into Doctor Who naturally. I mean, obviously the team is trying very hard at the moment to find them. And look, there are women out there who have been writing Doctor Who novels for a long time. There are many women who write in fandom. But I've got to say, novels aren't always a transition to TV. And, you know, writing a blog or having a podcast is certainly not a transition to TV. So I think people have just got to take it on balance that, yes, there are a lot of female fans now. Yes, they are doing creative things, but have they come up over the last 10 or 20 years in television, and are they at the point of actually writing TV drama? They might not be. So, you know, I think give it a bit of time. Let the team try and find some women, and let more women come up through the ranks. It's only going to be a good thing to see gender balance in the writing of Doctor Who, more thoughts, more worldviews coming into the team. And yeah, look, I think the future's very bright, but this whole concept that Stephen might be, you know, rejecting scripts just because they come from women, absurd, totally absurd. And hopefully if people won't believe Stephen, or people like myself who defend Stephen on topics like this, maybe, just maybe, they'll believe Neil Gaiman. Anyway, I'll get off my high horse on that topic. Coming towards the end of the week, I tossed out a friendly question to Vanessa Marshall, also known as Hera on Star Wars Rebels. I said to her, how stoked were you when you received, or how stoked will you be when you receive your first Hera action figure? And Vanessa came back to me and she says, when I got the Lego figure, I flailed. When I saw the Hasbro figure at San Diego Comic Con, I cried. Hashtag so stoked. So there's a nice bit of feedback from Vanessa Marshall. She's seen two different action figures of herself, a Lego figure and a Hasbro figure. And with regard to the Hasbro figure, at least she cried. I can totally understand that. I mean, Vanessa is a massive Star Wars fan in general, and I think any of us here who are Star Wars fans, if we saw ourselves not only in a show, but actually having an action figure made of our character, I think we might cry as well and be hashtag so stoked as well. Anyway, moving on. To close out this week, we've had some listener feedback from Ryder Waldron. Ryder's out there actually creating a lot of good stuff. He's submitting stuff in particular to the podcast Coffee with Kenobi. That's another podcast I might mention in weeks ahead that's really worth your time. And he asks, if you could be any Star Wars character, who would you want to be and why? Not necessarily your favorite character. Now, that's an awesome question, Ryder. And, you know, rather than try and answer it now, I think I'm going to call in the whole Who Wars team and ask them what they think and make a segment about this question. Stay tuned for that after the news. I think that's a question that's worth a bit more than a minute or so here in the intro to the show. All right then, to close out, please get in touch. Please drop me an email. Please write me something on Twitter. Please send in an MP3 if you've got anything to say to the show. Details on how to do that are all included at the end of the show in the closing credits. And as I say each week, if you have iTunes, please open it now and give us a rating and review. Your review only has to be one sentence, but that rating and review will really help us bump up the rankings and be found by other fans. People like yourselves, we're a grassroots kind of podcast, and we'd love to get bumped up the rankings in a really grassroots way. If you're listening to this show, you know, we don't ask for any money for the show. We don't have a Patreon account saying, please give us a dollar a week or something. We have none of that. It's all funded out of my pocket. So if you want to do anything nice for us, please drop into iTunes, give us a rating and review, and it would just be greatly, greatly appreciated. We'll also read them out on the show too, if that's an added bonus to you. Anyway, it's time for the news. Okay then, on to my top stories of the week. I realise I just called them news stories a moment ago. That is wrong. This isn't meant to be a comprehensive news coverage. This is just interesting stories I found this week that relate to Star Wars and Doctor Who. And the first one I found is a clip from the Graham Norton Show. The Graham Norton Show is a very funny British chat show. And on this episode, he had Benedict Cumberbatch, who I know is very popular out there from the amount of times I see him mentioned on my Twitter feed in particular, especially among Doctor Who fans, because Doctor Who fans tend to like Doctor Who and Sherlock together because they both have the same showrunner. So here we have Benedict Cumberbatch being asked a bunch of interesting questions, one of which is he in Episode 7 of Star Wars? He denies it, of course. There's no official word on that. But he does talk a little, just a little, about being on the set. Here's Ben.
Wow. Are you in the new Star Wars movie?
No comment. Of course I'm not.
I heard a rumor you were seen around the set.
I did go to set, which was fantastic. I mean, it was like walking through my childhood, and Harrison, whose place I'm honoured enough to be in on the sofa, it was... he wasn't there. I walked to the Millennium Falcon, I sat down. I mean, it was incredible. It was
I shouldn't be saying this on television.
It's a secret, don't tell anyone.
We know when that did it, because it fell on his foot. So,
that's right,
yeah, so
that's,
we know,
right.
Yeah.
That's right, that's already been spoiled. Yeah. That's
but
fine.
Did you not ask to be a stormtrooper or something?
No comment.
Are you a stormtrooper? Are you? Are you at the back of one of those people?
Unbelievable. No comment.
Actually, last time, as you say, you were here with Harrison Ford before. You did an incredible Chewbacca, but I'm told you also do a Jar Jar Binks.
Oh, no, it's a big sea monster.
You don't make much money out of doing a good Jar Jar, let me tell you that. The most loathed character of any franchise ever. Rightfully so, in my opinion. Yeah.
And Smaug the Dragon is back.
He is, yeah.
Christopher, finished business.
Moving on, I found this great story on the Associated Press. If it wasn't on Associated Press, I'd think it was made up. It's Dateline Kiev, Ukraine. One candidate in Ukraine's parliamentary elections hopes to bring voters to the dark side. Darth Alexievich Vader. Dressed in full Star Wars regalia, Vader prowls the streets of Kiev atop his black campaign van, wooing voters with promises to turn Ukraine into a galactic empire. So serious is he about the mission that he even legally changed his name to Darth Vader ahead of the elections. He was previously known as Viktor Shevchenko. And if you look at this story online, I'll throw a link to it in the show notes if I remember. You do see a picture of this black campaign van with Darth Vader on top of it. It's quite funny stuff. The electrician turned interplanetary warlord insists his internet party is serious business. Speaking to the Associated Press on his van, flanked by stormtroopers and shrouded in white fumes, Vader explained that his top goal is to computerize all government business. Quote, "When I get to Parliament, I will expel all deputies. They have proven their uselessness," he said. "Computers will work in their place and they will fulfill their functions without cease." End quote. Pollsters predict the party, which also includes a Stepan Chewbacca in its list, has little chance of getting into Parliament in Sunday's vote. Still, the public greets Vader enthusiastically when he drives around the capital atop his van, which he refers to as "my helicopter." I'm not sure what that's all about. Despite his pledge to enhance transparency, Vader declines to ever show his face. That got him banned from voting in May presidential elections by punctilious electoral commission workers who said he was violating voting rules. Vader is not shying away from thornier issues. To the ominous backdrop of the Imperial March from Star Wars, he thundered from the top of his van that he would win the war against separatist rebels in the east, even as he withdrew government troops, and he vowed to reclaim the Crimean Peninsula, which was annexed by Russia in March. How will he achieve these feats? "A military space station will be built," he said, "that will protect the whole territory of Ukraine." Ah, you gotta laugh. That's a good story. Okay, now on CNET, I found an interesting story. And again, if I remember, I'll toss this link into the show notes. And the story runs in part, The Star Wars laser is pretty great. Instead of bullets, it fires laser bolts, short bursts of laser that can be used as a weapon. Unfortunately, the fictional device would not work that way in the real world. For starters, laser pulses made of light move at the speed of light, too fast for the eye to see. If it could exist in the real world, though, we can now see what it would look like, thanks to a team of researchers from the Laser Center of the Institute of Physical Chemistry of the Polish Academy of Sciences and the Faculty of Physics, University of Warsaw. They used a new, compact, high-powered laser to send an ultra-short laser pulse through the air, filming it using an old camera trick, since most cameras cannot shoot at a speed of billions of frames per second. A modified camera was synchronized with the laser, which shot pulses at a rate of 10 per second. The laser pulses and the camera were ever so slightly out of sync, so that the camera recorded each image at a minimal delay from the previous one. A cloud of water vapor was used to make the laser more visible. In this way, the camera was able to film the passage of a laser pulse with each frame of the film a separate pulse. And again, if you refer to the link that I'll try to remember to throw into the show notes, you'll be able to see this on video. Very interesting story from CNET. Rounding out my stories this week, I wanted to talk about some Doctor Who merchandise. Now, I know there's tons and tons and tons of Doctor Who merchandise out there. It's almost like they took a page out of the Star Wars book, you know, from the late 70s, early 80s, and just, there is a Doctor Who logo on everything these days. But these are some of the more interesting ones that I thought I'd mention. The first is a Seventh Doctor replica umbrella. You might remember the Seventh Doctor had an umbrella, a longish umbrella, not quite a golf umbrella, but similar. And it had a red question mark for a handle. This was part of the pretty bloody awful, actually, overuse of the question mark on the 80s Doctors, like Davis and Baker and McCoy. But it was kind of a curious umbrella at the same time, used to great effect in Dragonfire when Sylvester hung over the edge by it, and in general, it's just an interesting looking umbrella. Well, there's been a really, really nice replica made of it. I'll throw the link into the show notes. And what I'm most impressed about, to be quite honest, is its price. It's $35, which, for the look of it, is fantastic. Whether you're going to cosplay the Seventh Doctor or not, this would make an interesting piece just hanging up in your study or hanging on your coat rack at home or whatever you might have. Whovians will just notice it at, you know, 50 paces. Oh my God, that's the Seventh Doctor umbrella. It looks really good. The price is good. It looks like pre-orders at the moment, so dive in, grab it. I don't obviously have one, but from the looks of things, it looks pretty damn good. The second thing I wanted to mention is the Siege Mode TARDIS. If you remember last week's episode, Flatline, the Doctor pulled a switch on the console at the last minute, just before he was about to be hit by a train, and the TARDIS went into Siege Mode. This is something we'd never seen before. It basically turned into a little cube with Gallifreyan-type iconography on it. And in some ways, I'm a bit disappointed that this product has appeared like the week after that episode went out. It's like it was designed maybe in that episode to be a piece of merchandising, and has been shared around with these people making it, you know, well in advance so they could have it ready to go the week that episode went out. But at the same time, it looks pretty good. You could use it as a paperweight. You could use it as something sitting on your shelf. It's a nice little Doctor Who thing. I mean, it's only been in one episode. It's a concept we've never heard of before, so it's not as iconic as a Dalek or a Cyberman or even the police box shell of the TARDIS itself. It is something that, let's not forget, has only been in one episode. But if you did like the look of it, I think this is about £40 or £50 or something along those lines. Made out of resin, but with aluminium powder sprinkled through the resin, apparently. So it probably has quite a nice look. Certainly not a toy, but just something to have as a paperweight or on your shelf, as I mentioned. Finally, the third piece of merchandise I want to mention is the Doctor Who Annual 2015 is now out. Annuals were such a big part of Doctor Who from the mid-60s right through into the 80s, then they went away for a while and then came back again with the 2005 series. The annual that was produced that year was obviously the 2006 annual, because traditionally the annuals come out towards the end of each year and are dated for the year ahead. So this is the first of the Peter Capaldi annuals. And I bought it as soon as I saw it was available. I didn't see any fanfare around it. It had actually been out for several weeks by the time I got around to buying it, but I've bought it. It's arrived now in the mail. And unfortunately, it's in the vein of the last few of the annuals. I guess they think that kids today have real attention deficit disorder problems, and they're really basic single page, maybe double page articles briefly describing concepts in the show like regeneration or who played the doctors over the years or little puzzle games. And there's really not much to them. Even in earlier annuals from the past 10 years, you know, if you go back to the 2006 or 7 annuals, there were decent short stories in them. Here there's a story so short it's barely a story at all. It's just a few paragraphs and it's not particularly interesting. And I think that's it on that count as I flick through the annual. It's a disappointment in many ways, but I've collected so many of the annuals. I mean, I have several of the 60s annuals, I have most of the 70s annuals, I've got all of the 80s annuals, and I've got every annual since the show returned, so it's almost something that I can't stop collecting, otherwise I feel like I'm missing out. But in terms of reading it, if you're an adult, or even, you know, a teenager with the reading abilities of an adult, you're not going to be too impressed by this at all. It's more of a collectible than something to put on the shelf, than something you really want to get hardcore about and, you know, read and really learn from. Just thinking of those earlier annuals from the run, you know, 2006, 2007, I remember Stephen Moffat had even written a short story in one of them. It was a Sally Sparrow story, you know, Sally Sparrow from the episode Blink. You know, so there used to be quite high-profile writers putting things into these annuals that were of real quality, but not anymore. And, you know, lest I sound like a man approaching 40 who's just, you know, over it, I can look back on annuals from the 60s or 70s or 80s and see the fiction in them and see how long it is and see how interesting the stories are. And compared to the piece in this annual, it's just chalk and cheese. The annuals were done so much better in the past, and even for an adult have more to them and more interest in them than this modern annual has. I'm really not selling this annual to you, am I? I'm really dissuading you from buying it. But again, if you've been collecting the annuals like me, I'm sure you'll pick it up. If you have a particularly young child, I'm sure they'd love it. There's lots of pictures, there's information that they'll get something out of. But if you're a teenager or above, it's just something to collect. It's not something I think you should be reading and taking seriously. Anyway, that's the end of the Doctor Who merchandise section for this episode. I hope you enjoyed my stories of the week. And without any further ado, because I know we've got an awful lot in this episode, let's kick on. Alrighty, so if we go back to the intro of this show, I had some listener feedback from Ryder Waldron, who asked me, who would you be? What character would you be in the Star Wars universe? And why? And it doesn't have to be, you know, obviously your favourite character, but what character would you be? And I gave this a lot of thought, and I thought it might be fun to actually throw it open to the Who Wars team as well. So we might come back to mine in a moment. Let's see what Lex is thinking. Let's see who Lex would be in the Star Wars universe if she was a character in it. Over to you, Lex.
So to answer this question, I needed something to help guide me to the right answer of what Star Wars character I wanted to be. You know, I want to be who I am. And that means that I needed a little help discovering who I am. So I took an online quiz. Good idea, right? Well, I got Queen Amidala, and I'm afraid that doesn't mean too much because I don't want to be Queen Amidala. She had a very stressful life. And I don't entirely agree with some of those life choices she's made. So I'm gonna have to go with Yoda, because he's so wise, and he has a good ending. He becomes one with the Force at the end of his life, and I already have his laugh. Occasionally, I've been known to do a Yoda laugh, and I already have his grammar. I just don't let it show on these podcast contributions. So, want to be Yoda, I would. Yes. Thanks for asking.
Alrighty, very interesting. And we also have Kate. Kate's weighed in with her thoughts on who or what she'd be. Let me press play on the tape and we'll find out now.
Okay, so if I could be any Star Wars character, who would I be and why? Wow, this is a really great question. And as big of a Star Wars fan as I am, you'd think I would have thought about this question my whole life, but I actually haven't. And it kind of caught me off guard and I had to think about it for a while. But my initial response was to say any of them, but I suppose that's probably too broad, and I'll give you something a little better than that. Now, R2-D2, he's my favorite, but I wouldn't want to be a droid. But I definitely would want to be someone Force-sensitive, And even though the Zumbio quiz says that I'm Darth Vader, I don't think I would necessarily choose to be Darth Vader. But I will stick with the Skywalker line and I'll go with Leia. Because even without using the Force, she showed herself to be a confident, strong woman. So I can only imagine how awesome she would be as a Jedi. So yeah, I choose Leia.
And again, like Lex, very interesting stuff there, Kate. For me, I gave this a lot of thought, and my favourite character in Star Wars is Han Solo, and I'm not going to say Han Solo, so I'm not choosing this character based on who I like the most in Star Wars. And my thought process around it was, I like Jedi characters, but I also like the pilot characters. I'm a big fan of the Rogue Squadron series of novels by Michael Stackpole and the dearly departed and greatly missed Aaron Alston. Those two guys wrote that whole series. They're just fantastic novels. So I've always loved those pilot characters, but I've also had a thing for Jedi. My favorite character, though, is Han Solo. You know, what do you do? And then it came to me in a big flash of inspiration. Han Solo is a Corellian. So let's think Corellian. Let's think great Corellian pilots. Well, we sort of end up with Wedge, but Wedge is maybe a bit too obvious. Who's another great Corellian pilot? And who might be a great Corellian pilot who's also a Jedi? And then I thought, obvious. Corran Horn. Corran Horn is a character. I haven't read a novel with him in it for a little while, but whenever I've read novels with him in it, I've really, really enjoyed them. If you've ever read the novel I, Jedi, you know, that very famous Star Wars EU novel, which was written in the first person, that was all about Corran Horn. And funnily enough, when you see Corran Horn in some artworks, we even look similar. Now, don't go and look at Corran Horn and assume that's me, because he is portrayed differently in different artworks and has been portrayed by at least one actor in the past in some still images, and I look nothing like him. But there are some pictures of Corran Horn where the facial structure and just the eyes and the eyebrows and all that sort of looks similar. I do believe he's quite short, though. I'm not short. I'm about 6'2", whereas Corran Horn is, you know, not even 6 foot. He's like 5'9 or 5'10 or something. But I digress. I think I would be Corran Horn. I'd like to be Corran Horn because he's got that Rogue Squadron affiliation. He's a Jedi. There's a tragic sort of side to him as well. I'm a sucker for tragic stuff in stories. And that was in the New Jedi Order, where he dueled one of the Yuuzhan Vong for the planet Ethor. And he won, but then they didn't honour the agreement they'd made. I think that was the premise there, and Corran Horn was quite shamed by that he'd bet the whole planet, and even though he'd won, he lost, if that makes sense. And that appeals, and he's got some great friends, he has a great story, and he's a Corellian, so it all fits. I think that's who I'd like to be. Anyway, what a great question, Ryder. Thank you very much for that. Ryder also asked what other listeners would like to be in the Star Wars universe. If you could pick a character, if you could identify with a character, not necessarily your favourite character, but a character, who would it be? Why not write in or tweet me or send in an MP3, and we'll keep this going if we get some responses. I think that would be very cool. I think it's a great question. Thanks again, Ryder. Now on to our next segment. Okay, moving on from something quite fun, chatting about who we'd be as Star Wars characters, to something maybe not so fun, maybe something a bit more serious, but I think a conversation that a lot of people out there are having, and if they're not having it, they might be at least thinking it, and if they're not having it or thinking it after they hear this, it certainly may become top of mind for them if they're a Star Wars fan out there watching Star Wars Rebels at the moment. But first, a little background. I guess being a Doctor Who fan, I'm well used over the last few series to seeing the overnight ratings figures come out, and they'll be at a certain level. And then over the week ahead, we get a what they call a consolidated figure, which is not just the people who watched overnight, but the people who then watched in other ways. They time-shifted through, you know, the BBC iPlayer, or they watched a repeat screening at some stage, or basically watched the show in some other form during that week, aside from the live broadcast, which is what the overnight ratings are. And the differences between the two can be quite staggering with Doctor Who. You know, you might have a figure of, I don't know, 6 million, 5 million overnight, and then you might have consolidated 2 or 3 million more on top of that. You might jump from thinking, oh, that's a fairly average kind of result, to thinking, gee, that was the second or third most watched show on UK TV that week. It does vary from week to week. Sometimes Doctor Who's up there in the top 5, sometimes it's top 10, sometimes it's top 20. It does go all over the place. I'm just giving this as a bit of a preamble, because with Star Wars Rebels coming out in the US and being so new, people are watching those ratings, you know, very, very closely. And obviously, there are ratings that come out overnight, and there will be consolidated ratings, or whatever they might call that in the US. Maybe they do call it consolidated ratings. I'm not sure. And there's certainly been a lot of chat about this online. People have been seeing, you know, the huge results that the debut movie Spark of Rebellion brought for Star Wars Rebels. And then they've watched the ratings go down, down, down. And that's got people worried, particularly people who just look at the ratings on face value and say, oh my God, what's happening? And you know, when you're on social media and you get into conversations with people about this, people have different opinions, people have different axes to grind. You know, I've particularly seen some Clone Wars fans almost reveling in the fact that Star Wars Rebels isn't doing well, and I say isn't doing well in air quotes, because their show got cancelled, so they're kind of happy, almost. You can almost sense happiness in their tweets that Rebels isn't doing so great. Other people, meanwhile, are saying, hey, it's already been renewed for a second season. Give it a chance. Let it bed in. Still others, and myself included, are saying, you know, this is a very big thing we're talking about, and there's more than just the show involved here. There's also the merchandise. There's also the eventual DVD sales. You know, Rebels might end up being phenomenally popular on DVD after its first season. So, you know, it's very hard to sit here after only a few episodes, and episodes that have gone out on different networks in the US. So we're not even always comparing apples and apples to really get a clear picture of what's going on. Anyway, I'm getting to the end of the preamble. When I was looking at, you know, the online conversation and getting involved in some of them, I, you know, was quite intrigued by the comments from one Twitter user, Yancey Evans. Unlike some of the people reveling that the ratings aren't going well, and unlike some who are just confused by it and, you know, aren't really delving any deeper than the surface numbers, Yancey had interesting and intelligent things to say. So I reached out to Yancey and I said, hey, would you like to come on the show and give your point of view? And unfortunately, time zones being what they were, we couldn't sit down on Skype and have a conversation about it. But what I did was put together a bunch of questions to Yancey, and Yancey has answered them as if I was asking them to him. So what I'm about to do now is ask questions, and you'll hear Yancey answer them, but I want to stress that we aren't having a conversation. This is questions being sent to him by email, and he's answering them by email. So it's not as interactive as you might like in a question and answer, but it is probably more interesting than me just reading out Yancey's answers from an email or something like that. So apologies, it's slightly less interactive than you might like, but I think when you hear what I'm asking and what Yancey has to say, it's a very, very interesting topic, and particularly if you're a bit unsure where things are at the moment with regard to Star Wars Rebels ratings, I think this could be enlightening. So, without any further ado, I'll pull up virtual Yancey, and I'll start asking my questions. Okay, Yancey, Star Wars Rebels has had an impressive debut. In your blog, you point out, quote, the one-hour movie premiere on Disney Channel had an estimated 6.5 million viewers worldwide, with another 75,000 watching Spark of Rebellion via the Watch Disney XD app or on iTunes. When the show made its move to Disney XD with the broadcast of Droids in Distress, it still managed to bring in some 1.03 million viewers in the US, making it the biggest animated premiere on Disney XD and its biggest animated show of the new fall season. End quote. Now, on face value, that looks pretty good. However, you do have issue with what comes next. Firstly, a big drop-off in numbers between Droids in Distress and Fighter Flight, and then something that not as many people might consider, which is a drop in female viewers. So, first question, what do you attribute to that large drop between Droids and Fighter Flight? I think the initial drop between Spark of Rebellion and Droids was a given, as most debuts, you know, rate higher than their week-to-week episodes. Plus, it had a wider potential audience in general, being on the Disney Channel and not XD. But that second drop between two shows that were on XD is, to me, odd. What are your thoughts?
Thank you for having me on, Rob. I appreciate it. To answer your question, like you said, obviously, the difference between Spark of Rebellion and Droids in Distress is mainly because we've moved from Disney Channel, which has a much wider potential audience. It's carried by about 90% of all cable and satellite providers in the United States, whereas XD is covered by about 68% of all cable and satellite providers in the U.S. So obviously there's going to be a jump, a drop in the ratings. I think the drop was probably a little high, but that had more to do, again, with the time and date. Mondays at 9 p.m. isn't really an optimal date. You know, it's a school night. Most parents are not going to have younger kids up that late. And you're only kind of shooting yourself in the foot there. So we're down to a million viewers with Droids in Distress, which again is a solid number. It's a great number for XD. Like Disney said, it was their highest animated premiere ever. And at the time, that would have made it its highest rated animated show of the fall. The problem is the drop, like you said, the drop between Droids in Distress and Fight or Flight. That's pretty bad. It's about a 43% drop. And you're going now from 1 million viewers to 580,000 viewers. Again, bad night, bad time. I think one of the things you can get out of that number is, just like Spark of Rebellion was a premiere for the show, in a way, Droids in Distress is also a premiere because it's the premiere of the show on XD. So, of course, there's going to be a little bit of a drop. Now, I honestly thought the drop was going to be more like a number around 800, maybe a little lower, 750,000 viewers. I thought the show was probably going to drop a little bit. I did not expect a 40% drop. And the biggest reason I can just think of, it has to be time and night. There's really just no other explanation other than the available viewer base is just not there. Now, the interesting thing is there are some additional demographics. When I looked at the numbers for Droids in Distress, there were some really interesting numbers that came out of that, which one of the things that you saw was the majority of viewers were actually people outside of the prime demographic range, which was 6 to 14 year old kids. It was people outside of that range. The majority of viewers, about 541,000 of them or so, I think it was 549, were outside of that. So you're talking about late teens, people in their 20s, 30s, parents who are watching the show with their kids, obviously. So the people who are not in the demographic you're trying to get, you've got more viewers in that in those demographics than you do in your prime demographic. I thought that was a little interesting. And again, I think that just goes to show that you're more likely to have adults or older teens watching the show at that time of night, because other kids are going to be going to school the next morning. Their parents are just not going to let them stay up that late. I think if the show were on like a weekend night, if it were like on Friday, even at the same time, I think the numbers would probably be a little bit better. So I think that's a lot of it.
Thanks for that. And the second part to that first question is, talk us through that drop in female viewers, particularly in light of Rebels having tremendous female characters in the shape of Hera and Sabine, and at least as far as the production is concerned, Rebels is really trying to have a real and genuine appeal to both sexes.
Yeah, I think the move to XD really hurt Rebels as far as the female demographic. The first episode, Spark of Rebellion, had some pretty decent numbers with female viewers. And that's kind of to be expected because the Disney Channel itself tends to have more female viewership. So the numbers were a little better. When the show moved over to XD, the numbers really pretty much tanked. There was a drop of about 78% of female viewers overall from Spark of Rebellion to Droids in Distress. And I know a lot of people kind of touted, oh, well, even with the Droids in Distress, you know, the, oh my gosh, you know, 25% of all viewers between the ages of 6 and 11 were females. Well, when you actually looked at the actual number, it was only about 73,000 girls at the time. So it's not really a number that's really that impressive. And it really is kind of a confusing message. It's a mixed message, and I alluded to this in my blog, that, you know, here's Lucasfilm really trying to make, and they have been for about 20 years through the EU, through the prequels and the Clone Wars, really trying to make inroads with female fans. And you can see it. You go to conventions, you'll see little girls dressed up as their favorite characters. It's definitely had an effect, you know, and brought more women into the fan fold. And I'm concerned with a show that Lucasfilm is targeting for everyone, clearly, with the way the show is broken down as far as males and females on the show. They're obviously trying to be a little more inclusive in that area. XD is not that channel for that. XD, even though Disney describes it as a channel for kids 6 to 11, in their own literature, they admit that the network is meant to be hyper-targeted toward boys 6 to 11. And in those demographics, they did real well in the show. I did a follow-up the next day, breaking down the demographics a little closer. And there were some really interesting things in there, and I really thought it showed where Disney's kind of missing the boat. We're going to look at I wanted to look closer and examine the demographic numbers for Droids in Distress. There was no information available for Fight or Flight. Disney hasn't made that available yet, and I don't expect those numbers will be released anytime soon, honestly. But the way it broke down was, as I said before, Droids in Distress had a little over 1 million viewers, and 481,000 viewers were kids in the range of 6 to 14. Of those viewers, 356,000 of them were in the 6 to 11 demographic, which is where they're really trying to highlight XD. That's their main demographic. And about 125,000 kids fell within the range of 12 to 14-year-olds. So you're talking about, you know, people in junior high, people just entering high school. Now, when you break down those numbers, the boys look like this. In the boys' demographic, you have 283,000 boys, 6 to 11, watching the show. And that makes up, of all the boy viewers, 76% of all boys are in the 6 to 11 age range. But when you get to the 12 and 14-year-old boys, the number really drops fairly steeply. You have about 86,000 boys, ages 12 to 14, and of course they make up 23.3% of all boys watching the show. Now, here's where it got a little interesting, and I really think they can make some inroads with female viewers if they gave the show a chance. So, like I said before, the numbers overall for girls weren't great. You had a total of, it was 112,000 girls ages 6 to 14 watched the show. So it broke down like this. You had 73,000 girls ages 6 to 11 watch the show. Of all girls, that group made 65% of all girls watching the show between the ages of 6 and 14. The interesting thing, though, is girls ages 12 to 14. Now, the number's not huge. It's 39,000 girls. But where the boys ages 12 to 14 made up 23% of all boys watching the show, girls 12 to 14 made up 34.8%, almost 35% of all girls watching the show were ages 12 to 14. And you sit back and you look at that number, and it makes sense. You have Sabine, a character that's a teenage girl. You have Hera, kind of this mother figure on the show. These are characters that girls can identify with, and older girls especially. And I think that's an area where Disney, if they considered either moving the show to Disney Channel or promoting it a lot more on Disney Channel and maybe rebroadcasting it on Disney Channel in a good time slot, you know, not something at 9, 10 o'clock at night, but a good time slot where girls might be apt to watch the show. I think they could really make some inroads there if they gave it a chance. You know, and it goes to other things that we're seeing within Disney, and I'm sure you've probably talked about it before, where like the first wave of Hasbro action figures don't include either Harris or Sabine. When the Disney stores unveiled all their product, when the lines first hit the Disney stores, you know, Princess Leia wasn't included in them. Queen Amidala wasn't included among characters. It was all Han, Luke, Chewie, the droids. It's just little things like that that make you wonder why Lucasfilm is really pushing hard to get girls involved in Star Wars. You know, and our main lead in Episode 7 is going to be, you know, a young woman. Why Disney seems to be stuck on pigeonholing Star Wars as a boys' line. Of course, it's always going to appeal to boys a little bit more. I get that. I mean, I'm 47 myself. When I grew up, Star Wars was, you know, it was pretty much all boys. You know, I had a few friends that were girls in grade school and in high school that were fans, but it was mainly boys. I get that. But I think Disney needs to really consider changing their mindset a little bit when it comes to Rebels and Star Wars in general down the road.
Okay. Now, do you think the time episodes go out is a problem? Some of the core audience are unlikely to be awake or allowed to watch TV at that time on a school night, even if they are still awake. Do you think they're time shifting the episodes and thus not showing up in the overnights?
I think almost everyone I've talked to as far as fans, I think everyone pretty much agrees that, you know, Monday at 9 o'clock in the evening is kind of a silly time to put on a show aimed at 6 to 11 year olds. It doesn't make a lot of sense being on a school night like that. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, you know, you take a look at some of the other shows, like the Marvel shows, their cartoons. They tend to air on weekends, and their numbers are better than, you know, this last episode of Rebels. I think if they don't move the time, I think you'll probably see the numbers pretty much stay where they're at. And as far from Disney's perspective, they may be completely okay with that. It is bringing in about 100,000 to 150,000 more viewers at that same time frame. You know, if these numbers stay the same, where it's bringing in, you know, about 580,000 viewers a week. I mean, that's a lot more than they had last year at the same time, in the same time slot. But this show really has the ability to break out and be one of their biggest animated shows, if not their biggest animated show, if they'll just give it the chance. I don't think the numbers reflect any kind of time shifting, because as far as I know, the show aired at 9 everywhere. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, so we're kind of on Central Time. It aired at 9 here. I know on the East Coast it aired at 9, and I know on California time it aired at 9, so I don't think there's any kind of time shifting as far as numbers like that. The other thing too, you know, I know a lot of people have pointed to, well, maybe people are DVRing the show and that would help the numbers. And the thing is, the reality is, especially with Disney shows on XD, the numbers on recorded shows and watching them at later times isn't very high. So that really wouldn't make that much of an impact. And also, the Watch XD, you know, people have also pointed to the Watch XD app. I doubt very many people other than hardcore Star Wars fans are watching through the XD app. You know, the numbers for the premiere, Spark of Rebellion, were 75,000 total viewers, and that was through the XD app and iTunes together. So I don't think that, you know, especially in follow-up weeks, you know, the numbers are going to drop off there. I don't think that that's having that much of an impact. So, you know, as I wrote in one piece, you know, the numbers are the numbers, and you just kind of have to deal with those numbers and see what we have. And I hope the numbers go up, but you know, as long as the show stays on at this same time frame, you know, Monday nights at 9 p.m., I just don't see those numbers changing that drastically.
Now, this is something I alluded to in my preamble before we got talking here. Some of the more doom and gloom posts I see out there on social, not from yourself, but just in general, are from people who are still clearly upset at the fact Clone Wars got cancelled. And to be straight up about it, I've almost ended up in arguments over Clone Wars with some of those people, such as their anger and bile about the show's cancellation. Do you think some of this doom and gloom reporting is by people who actually want to see Rebels failing? Because to them it would be at least something, you know, some kind of payback on the show that they see as having replaced their show.
I think there's, there's a certain segment of people who are still upset about the Clone Wars being canceled. I mean, I'm one of them. I wish the show had gone on another 2 or 3 years. By and large, I actually think the doom and gloom is more along the lines of people who are kind of familiar with Disney's practices, and just when a show starts getting, you know, an animated show starts getting good, they chop the legs out from under it and cancel it. Some fans have talked about the Greg Weissman curse. You know, he's one of the writers, producers on this first season of the show, and his shows never go more than 2 seasons, and some only go 1. So people think, you know, the show's cursed in that way. There's other fans who said, yeah, this show, you should watch it because this show's a lot like Firefly, and then, you know, they've kind of cursed the show with the Firefly curse that it's only going to last, the 1 season, and they're going to kill it. I don't think anybody's going to be killing Rebels this season. And you know, they've promised a 2nd season. I doubt they cancel it then, too, because you've got the lead up to Episode 7. You'd want to at least have some kind of presence on the air. So I don't think that's, you know, any of that's likely to happen. But, you know, I'm sure there's a certain segment of Clone Wars fans who are still kind of bitter, but I don't think it's very large. I think it's really more of a fringe part of the fan community. Most Clone Wars fans I've run into have really given the show a shot, and most of them like it. A few kind of don't. They like the broader stories and the animation style of the Clone Wars more than that, and that's fine. But I think, by and large, most Clone Wars fans are really supportive of the show because they really are supportive of Dave Filoni, and they want to see him succeed, and they want to see him stick around. So, you know, while there is that element, and every bit of fandom has that element, the doom and gloom naysayers and the people who want things the way it used to be and want something to fail because it doesn't meet that expectation. Like I said, I don't think that that's a major part of it.
All right. Now, if the ratings stay around Fight or Flight ended up at, what do you think the answer might be going forward? Is it a move onto the Disney Channel, a move away from XD?
I think ultimately, if the ratings stay where they're at, especially this upcoming, you know, Rise of the Old Masters, which is really an outstanding episode. If that episode can't get people to come and watch the show, I really don't know what other episode can. Disney may be put in a position where they have no choice but to at least move the time slot, and that's a possibility. I could see that happening. You know, I don't think they bought the Star Wars license and they went ahead canceled the Clone Wars and commissioned a new animated series to only see it having, you know, bringing in 580,000 viewers a week. I think they want to see that definitely expand. I think maybe you'll see the show air more on Disney Channel. I know here in the States, they have like an XD block on some nights where they show some of the more popular XD shows on the Disney Channel. That's a real possibility. But if the ratings kind of stay where they're at right now, I suspect they're going to probably keep the show on XD. And if they do, they'll probably just look at a different time slot for the show, which, they, you know, that's fine. Just so long as we can get more viewers to the show. In a perfect world, I'd really like to see the show on the Disney Channel and then maybe rebroadcast on XD. That would be my preference. Or even, you know, we'll see what happens with this special broadcast this weekend of Spark of Rebellion with the added Vader scenes. If it does extremely well there, you could very well see the show as kind of like a Sunday evening intro to the regular block of shows they have in prime time. You know, if it does real well in ABC, there's a lot of different options they could go there. So, you know, we'll see with that. But, you know, I'm hopeful the ratings will get better. But usually when a show falls the way it does, from its premiere to that second week, that next week kind of gives you an indicator where the show's ratings are going to be. So I think we're probably kind of looking at anywhere from, you know, regularly 520 to sometimes 620,000 viewers a week. So we'll see.
Cheers for that. Do you have any closing thoughts on the topic?
I would just encourage people to watch the show. I think, you know, for your listeners in the United States, the big thing is, you know, for U.S. ratings, is getting as many eyeballs on the screen. So if you're a fan of the show, even if you watch it on the XD app, you know, go and watch the show again when it broadcasts. You know, tell your friends about it. Get on your social networks and talk about the show and get as many viewers watching the show as you can. You can even, you know, send a mail, you know, send a letter to the people at XD telling them how much you love the show. I think that's probably the best way to keep the train moving ahead. You know, if you didn't want to watch the show because you thought it was too juvenile and it's the Disneyfication of Star Wars, I'll tell you straight up, it's not. It's a great show. It has the same heart as all the Star Wars films, and it really does stand up as something that's worthy to be called Star Wars. So that's just my thoughts on it.
Thanks for your time, Yancey. I do really appreciate you taking the time to answer my questions. Where can people be in touch with you or see more of your stuff?
Well, thank you for your time, Rob. I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about it. If people want to reach me, the two best ways, you can find my blog, which is, the blog is called One Saga. It's, you know, it's about the entire Star Wars saga. I talk about all kinds of things. You know, I talk about, I just call it, you know, my observations about the Star Wars universe. And I talk about all kinds of things. I analyze things. I review shows and books, all kinds of stuff. The blog's relatively new, but you can find it over at onesaga.wordpress.com. That's where I'm at. And if you want to hit me up on Twitter, my handle is Galandro1. That's Galandro, like the villain in some of the Brian Daley Han Solo novels. So that's GALLANDRO1. And that's my Twitter handle. You can hit me up there. I'd be happy. I love talking about Star Wars with fellow Star Wars fans. So thanks again for your time.
My thanks again to Yancey for doing that for us. It was a really, really interesting discussion. I know there was a lot of facts and figures, and maybe sometimes on a podcast, particularly if you're driving along, it might sometimes be hard to concentrate on it all, but go back and have another listen to it if you didn't catch it all the first time around. There's a lot of information in there about where Rebels is sitting at the moment, and I think it's not a message of doom and gloom that Yancey has, or that I'm trying to promote here, but a sense that here's where the show's at, here's where it could go, here are some possibilities, and it will be interesting to see if any of those possibilities are taken up, whether Rebels goes to the general Disney Channel in the US and maybe gets replayed on XD, or, you know, maybe it gets a new time on XD, or what might happen, who knows, or maybe this season will just bubble along, and then as I kind of have this thought at the back of my head that it really might take off when that first season gets on DVD and Blu-ray, and people sit down and binge watch it and go, oh wow, this is really good stuff, and then they're hooked for the second season onwards. You know, we've seen that in so many shows in the past. You only have to look at how many people originally watched Game of Thrones, and while the viewership wasn't all that bad, just seeing it grow year after year after year as more people come on board, and a lot of those people have come on board through, you know, binge-watching the first season or two on DVD, and then they're hooked, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think the future is bright for Rebels because it's a great concept. It looks good, it's well acted, the scripts are great, it's got success written all over it. It just has to find its groove at the moment. Anyway, to close, this segment has been a good example of grassroots podcasting. This is something I'm very big on, and I've started talking about in recent episodes. And by grassroots, I mean fans talking to fans, because at the end of the day, that's what we all are. You know, no matter how big a podcast might get, the people presenting it are still fans. So for us, as a slightly smaller podcast here, just in our 11th episode, we are really all about the grassroots. We are really all about people. If you've got an idea for a segment, whether it's a weekly segment or a semi-regular segment or a one-off kind of thing, a conversation you and I might have or something you might want to record and have me play on the show, please get in touch. That's grassroots podcasting. That's fans communicating with fans. And that's not, you know, those of us on the Who Wars team sitting up on a throne being all high and mighty and saying, here's all our opinions and not listening to you. This is us wanting you to come into the tent. Come into the tent and give us your opinions. Come onto the show and give us your opinions. It's something I'm very big on, and it's something I'd love to see more of going forward. Maybe this Q&A with Yancey might give you some ideas.
Ezra and Zeb's constant bickering continues, pushing Hera to send them off ship on a mission to spend quality time together.
You want me to carry your supplies after saving your life?
Stop saying you saved my life.
Never the ones to avoid an Imperial entanglement, the boys pick a fight, allowing Zeb to show off his piloting skills. Throughout this misadventure, Ezra and Zeb learn to work together, potentially even forming a friendship.
You collect these, right?
I already have that one. But this is a nice one.
Okay, and that was Andy Gutierrez talking about the latest episode of Star Wars Rebels Fighter Flight in Rebels Recon. That's a video series you can watch every week at youtube.com/StarWars, and it's a very cool series too. Now to talk about the episode, I'm joined here by my wife Leo. Say hello, Leo.
Hello, Leo.
You used that joke last time.
It never gets old.
Now, this was a very Zeb and Ezra episode, following on from, I guess, what was a very Zeb episode last time with droids in distress. Now, you like Zeb, so presumably you didn't mind this.
I did not mind it at all. And actually, I rather like that this episode introduced a bit of character interaction and development between Zeb and Ezra, and that was really great to see.
Yeah, certainly not with the rest of the crew. We saw a little bit with them, but largely this episode was Zeb and Ezra just dashing around Lothal doing crazy stuff.
It took us for one crazy ride.
Now, in the lead up to the episode, it was made clear that Ezra would be rescuing people who knew his parents, and I thought this might have given us some background into Ezra and his background, similar to the background we got on Zeb in the last episode where we heard about the weapons that had, you know, destroyed his people and all that sort of stuff. But here, aside from the fact that the character, I think his name was Morad Suma, he knew Ezra's parents and we sort of got told that, but then that was it.
You know, I'm actually kind of okay that they're not revealing everything about Ezra's past all in one go. If they trickle that in, that's fine. But it's nice to see little splashes of where he came from. I mean, every episode so far is focused on the planet where he is from, so we haven't even gotten away from his home yet. Not really.
Yeah, they seem to be using that as a base of operations, which is interesting, because I imagine if they keep coming back to this place, they're going to get found out sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's actually kind of bothered me a little. It doesn't seem like, you know, because there's just, it's a big universe, the Star Wars universe, and I'd love to see more of it. But if the focus is supposed to be on Ezra and his story, then maybe we're kind of stuck with a few places he can go.
Mm. It's just like they're always landing a few kilometers out of town, and it's like the Imperials don't twig onto this or something.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to fly with me. They're not very secretive if they're always going to the same spot. But, you know, maybe that's just how they roll.
Yeah. Now, as to how Ezra rolls, he's, you know, his trying to use the Force was made fun of a few times in this episode.
I enjoyed that.
I was going to say, did you like the sort of downplaying of the Force? You know, I'm thinking of Chopper holding up the bowl at the start to make him think he'd levitated the bowl. Zeb mocked him and said, you know, use the Force. And then he couldn't, you know, lift the lid off that box of fruit. So is it nice that he's not all powerful and pulling off, you know, amazing stuff from the get-go?
Yes, he's not pulling a Luke Skywalker, although Return of the Jedi on us, suddenly, like, becoming this powerful figure overnight. That's refreshing.
Yeah, and I guess there were shades of Luke Skywalker for me in a different way, though, when the Imperials destroyed the farmhouse.
Yeah, I saw that, too.
From the architecture of the farmhouse, you know, I mean, they're in some sort of grassland. They're not in the desert. But it sort of looked like the houses on Tatooine and, you know, Luke's aunt and uncle being killed. It just had shadows of that to me.
I was about to cringe at that moment when we saw the smoke and the farm, and I thought, oh, they're just going to repeat all the same old stories that we've heard before. But it worked out okay, and I really liked the mission, well, not the mission, but the rescuing of the prisoners. That whole sequence kind of made up for it.
Yeah, we got to see more of the Imperial transports there, which are a direct copy, as many people will know, of the old 1970s Imperial transport toy. And where they were keeping those prisoners is where you used to keep your action figures with that toy.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, well, I guess there would be a percentage of the audience who don't, especially younger people, who never had that toy. But to those of us who had that toy or who played with that toy when we went to our friend's house, you know, in the early 80s, it's like a big toy come to life when I see that on screen.
That's great.
Now, I'm getting the feeling that just over 20 minutes, once the adverts are removed, is a very short time to be telling a complete story. I guess they just want to do a few short stories at the start, but I'm wondering if we'll get into some 2- and 3-part story territory at some stage to really, you know, flesh something out.
Well, I hope there are going to be story arcs as we go. I think before they can do that, they need to really, you know, we've seen a lot of Zed now, we're getting a better feel for Ezra, but we haven't seen a lot of Hera and Kanan yet, and Sabine's still a bit mysterious, although I think she might be easier to work out, like, her personality seems pretty straightforward, but I think they're going to have to touch on each of those characters, how they interact with each other, before they can do, like, big stories involving all of them together.
Yeah, so maybe some more single episodes that focus down on some characters.
And short stories are fine. Like, this one didn't feel nearly as short as the episode, the last episode, for example. I felt like they did a fair amount of character development in a short period of time in such a way that it didn't really seem that short.
Was that maybe because they didn't have to concentrate on 3PO and R2?
Quite possibly.
Hmm. Now, what do you think at the end when they said they crashed the TIE? Before they were, you know, when they were flying along in the TIE, I got the sense they were going to do something sneaky with it. And we didn't see what they did. And then they simply said to Kanan at the end, oh, we crashed it. Do you think they've done something other to it? We might come back to that?
My imagination, like, kind of thought, well, maybe they gave it to somebody to sell or to scrap or something. But it wasn't presented in a way that I could really buy. Like the way it was an in-joke between Zeb and Ezra, it just seemed like it was something we as the audience were supposed to know. But I really don't have a clue what they were going to do with it. I imagine it was something altruistic, though.
You just gave me a thought. Maybe they gave it to Morad Suma so we could get off the planet or something.
I was thinking of that, but that wouldn't be a very practical way of getting two people off the planet. It was still a bit weird seeing Ezra and Zeb in a TIE fighter together, but whatever.
Yeah, true.
But it's not a very big ship.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think they were taking some liberties, perhaps, with the way they had both of them in the cockpit with what appeared to be lots of room to spare.
Oh, yeah. Lots of space.
Yeah. Now, ratings-wise, this episode only did about half of what Droids in Distress did. And elsewhere in this episode, I'm chatting with a fan, Yancey Evans, about, you know, ratings in general. But do you find it weird that it's bled off viewers so soon?
Well, maybe because it's taken such a different approach to, say, Clone Wars did. I can't really think of why it would drop off. I really like this episode a lot better than the last, as I've said, but... Mm. It seems to be that shows drop off very quickly in the beginning, and maybe it'll top out later. I don't know. That's just very strange to me that people are clicking off already.
Yeah, well, it dropped a bit from the premiere movie to the first episode, and by first episode I mean Droids in Distress. But that's sort of understandable because that debut movie went out on the Disney Channel in the US, and now the regular episodes are on Disney XD, which has less subscribers, so instantly you expect a drop. But then for Droids in Distress to sort of drop so heavily to this episode when they're both on XD, it's like a lot of people have tuned out for some reason this week after Droids in Distress.
A lot of that could have been the confusion of where and when they're supposed to watch the show.
Possibly.
Not everyone has access to it. That's one thing. Some people who are big Star Wars fans might just not have the Disney Channel or whatever. And I don't know. Maybe people were expecting it to be more Stormtroopers versus Rebels. And it hasn't quite gotten to that point yet. Maybe it is quite confuddling.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. I sort of have a feeling that they might be happy with the toy sales, and then once it goes to DVD, you know, probably a whole new audience will pick up on it at that stage.
That's true. The way people watch shows is a lot different nowadays. If you can get it all in one go and skip all the commercials and adverts and whatnot, you know, more people are going to watch it from start to finish that way, probably.
Yeah, and even in today's market, even with, you know, quite passionate Star Wars fans, I've run into people who didn't even know the show existed. So, you know.
Wow, okay.
Well, it seems crazy to people like you and I, but, you know, for others who quite like Star Wars and would probably give it a go, they just don't even know it's out there yet. It's very, very early days.
Well, it might be hard to figure out what the target audience for something like this is, because it is CGI and adults that have been, you know, have been grown up on Star Wars are probably thinking, oh, it's going to be another thing like Clone Wars. Well, either I was into Clone Wars and therefore I'll give this a go, or I wasn't into Clone Wars and I won't give it a go, or it's too cartoony, or, you know, maybe they just write it off because of the style.
Yeah, well, it's also going out on Monday nights in the US at a fairly late hour, so...
Oh, that's a ridiculous time to put it out.
Yeah, well, a chunk of the audience would probably be either asleep or, you know, not allowed to be watching TV at that time because they're about to go to bed.
Right.
So, yeah, so I guess some people are recording it on their, you know, PVRs and things like that, and there might be higher ratings once they factor in other things.
Yeah, well, yeah, people will probably want a marathon episodes back to back at their own convenience. So
yeah, anyway, it is early days, so I don't want to dwell on that. I certainly don't want to give people the impression that, you know, Rebels is going down the tubes. It's already been set up for a second season, so, you know, it's going to be with us for some time yet, and a lot could happen in the meantime.
And as we get closer to episode 7, I think people will want to have everything Star Wars. They'll get their hands on it eventually.
Oh, hell yes, hell yes. So, look, overall, what did you think of the episode? Could you give it a score out of 5 or a score out of 10? Or
out of 10, I'd give it maybe an 8.
You liked it that much?
I really love stories that focus on character development, and there were some good laughs, there weren't many cringeworthy moments. My favorite bit of the episode was that the ending was the same as the beginning. But the tone obviously had shifted because you'd seen these characters that really kind of despised each other. Well, not despised each other, but, you know, they weren't getting along, and then at the end they were. I really enjoyed that. I thought they pulled that off very well.
Oh, well, cool.
Yeah, I might not give it an 8 out of 10, but certainly, you know, maybe a 7 out of 10 for me or something like that. I didn't mind it. It was quite pleasant. And I like Sabine's drawing.
Oh, yes. Sabine's drawing was quite excellent.
I'm certainly looking forward to some more Sabine episodes.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Alrighty. Well, look, thank you for joining me again to talk Star Wars Rebels.
Thanks for having me.
From your studio down the hallway from me.
Yes.
And we might see you next week.
Well, you will see me next week.
I'll see you later on today.
Maybe.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
My name is Amelia Pond. Since I was a little girl, I've waited 12 years and 4 psychiatrists for a podcast. When I grew up, it finally came. Its name is Who Wars. It's from a galaxy far, far away. They want minds that are bigger on the inside, such as yours. So send something. I sent something and I've been listening ever since.
Hello! Oh, hi, children! Aren't we all very okay, we're doing this again. Hi. Aren't we all excited? It's time for my Doctor Who review. Yay! Oh, we're done doing that. I really enjoyed this episode, Flatline. I think I enjoyed it so much also because I read Flatland and Flatterland in my younger years. And boy, was it nice to have that flashback to the concept of thinking in 2D. Really cool. So yeah, I'm a fan of this episode. Jamie Matheson has done a great job, 2 in a row, in my opinion. Both have been really great. I thought, however, the Boneless, as a name for the monsters, a little strange. I feel like they should have picked something more relative to 2D. I mean, Boneless, when I think of Boneless, it just doesn't signify being flat exactly. I mean, think of boneless chicken breast. Chicken breast is not flat. Nobody buys flat chicken breast, right? Or Harry Potter's arm after Professor Lockhart tries to fix it and it's all floppy and gross without bones. I mean, that also didn't apply. These monsters weren't all floppy. So what's going on with the name choice there? The Boneless? Okay. Personally, I would have gone with a name like The Pancakes. The Pancakes? Scariest monsters ever? What do you think? No? Yeah, it probably is more of a bad band name than a monster. Oh dear, I just checked. The Pancakes is a band name. Sorry, no offense, guys. Here, I'll play some of their music to make up for it. Ladies and gentlemen, The Pancakes. This song's called A, just the letter A. And I'm sure that stands for Ain't That Nice. They've got a nice beat. Imagine this playing with the Dr. Clara and the graffiti boys and the monsters running after them. Yeah, this is good. So Siege Mode made an appearance for the first time, I believe. It looked a lot like the Pandorica, which I suppose makes sense because they are designed to do the same thing, let nothing in, nothing out. And then also we had Missy at the end again. But is it just me or is this getting kind of boring now? This has got to be the longest drawn-out lead-in to a baddie in the history of television. They don't even give her any interesting lines anymore. I'm sure if you could gather all of the lines that she's had so far, you could probably have something within the range of 140 characters. I'm talking about a Twitter post here. That small. That insignificant. She's really scary and we haven't heard anything important about her since, what, the second episode? Come on! Oh, listen, Pancakes is about to end. There it is, folks. Off they went back to their two-dimensional world. So hi. Just my voice again. Hello. So in this episode, the Doctor had his back off, I protect this planet speech. Personally, I'm still partial to the 11th Doctor speech. He had me at, hello, I'm the Doctor. Basically, run. It's gonna take a lot for something to knock that down from the top of the best Doctor Who speeches list. Though the 12th Doctor is doing an amazing job. I think he said his Get Out of My Galaxy speech really naturally. His gestures, the way he phrased things, you know, it wasn't like drawn out, but it had a lot of power behind it. So kudos, Peter Capaldi. He's fantastic. Sometime I want to finish watching all of the classic Doctor Who episodes, and while I'm doing it, collect every back off, this is my planet, it's protected speech ever made, and I'm going to make some kind of fan art out of it, like a video or something. Just wait. Yeah, I'm a huge dork. But wouldn't that be cool? All right. With that, I'll leave you till next week. Bye!
Forest of the Night is an absolutely wonderful story that takes us into the heartland of the dark and mystical fairy tale, which is the forest.
In the Forest of the Night by Frank Cottrell Boyce, one of the most lyrical and beautiful ideas for an episode we've ever had on Doctor Who.
It's a wonderful script, it's very magical, and a very original story. And it does one of the things I really love about Doctor Who, it's sort of genuinely funny and genuinely quite haunting.
So many Doctor Who stories are about Earth being invaded. This is about Earth invading us. This is about what would happen if all the trees turned against us.
Okay, and on to this week's Doctor Who episode. It was called In the Forest of the Night, and I know a lot of people had been looking forward to this because in trailers and in preview sort of pictures, you could see that London was covered by a big forest, and just the CGI, the effects alone, looked fantastic, and so people were tuning in, really curious to see what was happening. I even raised that the little girl in the trailer seemed to be being stalked by a wolf and was wearing a red coat. She was a little like Red Riding Hood. What was going to happen? Well, I've seen it now, and I'll start off with a little bit of backstory. When I was a kid, and I would watch TV shows, I think I may have even mentioned this on past podcasts, I never used to like seeing other kids in those shows. I was interested in adults and what adults were doing and adults doing adult things. That's what I was into. So when I would watch Doctor Who, I'd see, you know, I don't know, the Fourth Doctor and Sarah Jane. They were two adults having adult adventures, you know, and moved into the Peter Davison era, who is my Doctor. Same again. And I used to love that. In comics, in cartoons on Saturday morning, I like to see adults doing adult things. I'd watch The Real Ghostbusters, for example. They were adults doing adult things. I think I've laboured this point enough. I never used to like it when there were kids in shows, even when I was a kid, and that's pretty much continued into my adulthood. So I just wanted to make that clear before I get into saying, gosh, there were a lot of kids in this episode and it was kind of annoying, that you don't think I'm just a grumpy old bugger these days. I never liked kids and things when I was a kid. So let's just get that out on the table. And this episode had an awful lot of kids in it. Now, in their defense, they were very, very good actors. Some of them, their timing, their comedy, it was very, very good. The little girl playing Maeve in particular was just great. You know, there's no complaints about the way they sold their performances. They were at the top of their game. Child actors today, not streets ahead, but, you know, whole cities ahead, whole continents ahead of where child actors used to be in, well, even, you know, 10 years ago, but I'm thinking back to, say, the 70s and 80s on TV. Child actors today are just phenomenal compared to them. So in terms of how the children appear in the episode, in terms of how they act, just fine. I'm not into this idea of the Doctor having lots of school kids come into the TARDIS and, you know, pushing buttons on the console. Oh, don't push this and, you know, sit down, you know. To me, it's not Doctor Who. And in saying that, I'm acutely aware that one should not be closed to different concepts in Doctor Who. and that next season we might not see another school kid again, you know, because I think if Clara's going, then we might not have that link to Coal Hill School, we might not have kids in the next series. So Doctor Who is always changing, and just because there are, you know, kids in this episode, and there have been kids in several episodes this season, I shouldn't be too worried that it's going to go on forever. Nor should I be complaining, because Doctor Who is always about change. I get all that. I just wanted to flag up front that this episode, having all these kids in it running around, wasn't really my cup of tea. Onto the theme itself, though, I was fascinated by this idea of the forest growing up overnight. And, you know, Doctor Who is a science fantasy, and so it's completely believable that this, you know, event has happened. What wasn't so believable, though, is that the Doctor and these school kids were the only people wandering about the forest. Apart from Maeve's mother as well, of course. I mean, London is a very well-populated city. And even with the government saying, hey, don't go outside because we're going to try and burn down, you know, paths through the forest, you can't tell me that people wouldn't have got up that morning, even before those messages from the government went out, and went wandering into town to see these trees surrounding Nelson's Column or other famous London landmarks, you know, maybe over to one of the big cathedrals or the West End or some of the big bridges. You know, you can't tell me that in a city with so many people in it, there wouldn't be more people wandering around. So, you know, it's hard to talk about reality when a forest has grown up overnight, but to me it wasn't too realistic that the only people wandering around for all these hours would be just the Doctor, the kids, and Maeve's mother. There would be plenty of other people out just to sightsee, just to see this amazing thing. So that didn't sit entirely well with the way, I guess, my brain tries to rationalise what's going on in the world around the story, if that makes sense. But this concept of the forest growing and the way it looked was interesting. I was enjoying it right up until the point where Clara basically led the Doctor back to the TARDIS under the deception that he could save all the kids, and it was really just to save him. And then we have the scene where the Doctor, in the end, agreed that, I can't stop this, I'm going to leave, you're right. And it seemed quite genuine. That didn't sit entirely well with me from what we know of the Doctor. I mean, he did give that great line about, you know, being able to stop some things but not being able to stop physics. I get that. But the Doctor character to me is someone who's always going to try and who will be there right up until, you know, the final moment. So the way he did give in there didn't come across quite realistically to me either. That was a bit weird. And then moving into the final phase where, you know, Maeve is, you know, in communication with the forest and what the forest is trying to do, you know, providing this buffer from the solar flare. You know, I can go with that. Again, Doctor Who is science fantasy, you know, just because something is not fully explainable by science, I don't mind, because, hey, at the end of the day, Doctor Who is not Star Trek. It's not trying to be science fiction, it's science fantasy. So, you know, that's cool. It brings back memories of Kill the Moon, where the moon was an egg and had been there for billions of years and then hatched, and then instantly the creature could produce another egg, you know, bigger than itself. Again, totally bonkers when you look at the science of it. But in a science fantasy show, I can go with it. So I didn't mind Maeve being in communication with the forest and, you know, the forest eventually saving the Earth. That was fine. And I've got to say, I really did enjoy that line from the Doctor where, you know, he says that the human race will forget all of this. And Clara says, how can we forget this? How can we forget a forest that just, you know, sprang up overnight? And he says, you know, the human race is so good at forgetting things, you know, and if we weren't good at forgetting things, we'd never fight wars and we'd never have babies. And that's the kind of really Doctorish great comment that you have to sit back and really think about. And obviously, when you think about it, you realise by forgetting things, we unfortunately go to war time and time again. It's something we do. On the flip side, though, the having babies comment I thought was just beautiful, because I think what it's really saying is if you don't have babies, you don't have these little people to care for and worry about and, you know, maybe see die before yourselves, you know, and having offspring can be quite tragic. But because we forget, we keep having babies. And it's a good thing to keep having babies, so it's a good thing to forget. I thought that was some beautiful, beautiful poetry there. Anyway. Then we come to the little reveal of Missy watching this all and being surprised by the result. Curiouser and curiouser. You know, Missy remains a mystery to me, at least this close to the finale. The next two episodes are basically one story and we'll cap off the series. It's all coming up to an end very, very soon, and I have no idea how it's going to end. I am going to do a little preview on the next two episodes based on what Doctor Who magazine has to say in a segment coming up next, but generally I don't know where all of this is going. So to summarise, I've briefly gone through this episode. I haven't even touched on things like the relationship between Danny and Clara, Clara continuing to lie to the Doctor, the relationship between Clara and the Doctor, Clara leaving her marking in the TARDIS, which leads Danny to realise that she's still been seeing the Doctor. You know, this is very much an affair, but in a non-sexual kind of way. You know, rather than leaving a bra or something in the TARDIS, she's left her school marking. But I don't really want to touch on all that stuff. I think that's come up a lot in recent reviews that I've done here, and I think I've said all that I've had to say and all that I still really think. I think Clara is heading towards disaster. The little preview we got for the next two episodes kind of indicates that something is up. So let me just cut to the chase then and say, even though I've had these issues that I've discussed all through this review, I still found this a solid episode of Doctor Who. Again, having kids isn't to my liking, but the kids did a good job. The world surrounding this episode, a world where apparently no Londoners got outside, aside from just a small group of people, just didn't ring true. But that's okay too. The science, don't care. It's science fantasy. I can go with it. So, all in all, I'd give this maybe a 7 out of 10, maybe a 7.5 out of 10. It certainly wasn't an episode that made me recoil in horror or made me want to sit down here in front of the mic and say, that was just the worst episode I've ever seen. No, nothing of the sort. It just wasn't remarkable to me. It just didn't speak to me. And that's okay. It may have spoken to other people. Others may have watched that and thought it was the most incredible thing they've seen, you know, in the last month. I don't know. Write in and let me know, you know, what you thought of it, whether you liked it or whether you didn't. I don't pretend that the way I watch Doctor Who and the things I look for in Doctor Who are in any way the things that make Doctor Who right. But for me, yeah, it was pretty much just an average episode of Doctor Who. It didn't offend me, but it didn't thrill me. It didn't make me want to run away, nor did it make me wish there were, you know, 10 extra minutes in it. It was just an episode. I'm certainly looking forward to what comes up in the next couple of episodes. That preview made it look good, and from what we know from Doctor Who magazine, again, I'll chat about that in the next segment. I think there's some good stuff ahead. We sometimes just have to wade through, you know, regular sort of episodes like this to get there, I guess. Anyway, again, what did you think? Write in and let me know. Tweet me, email me, Facebook me, send in an MP3, whatever you like, and all the details on how to get in touch are in the credits at the end of the show. Okay, so it's no surprise that the final two episodes of this series of Doctor Who, Dark Water and Death in Heaven, have been hotly anticipated ever since we started to see the Missy character at the end of episodes during the series. And ever since we started to see images from the final two episodes, images which clearly show the Cybermen, people have been wondering about these last two episodes. And now, after we've seen the preview for next week's episode, which is Dark Water, and we've seen Clara saying, you know, Clara Oswald has never existed, we've seen Clara threatening the Doctor with the TARDIS key and saying he'll never get back inside the TARDIS, people are wondering, is this finally where Clara turns? Is this finally the Greek tragedy of Clara? As Al from the Diddly Dumb podcast would put it, is this finally where Clara has her great fall, basically, and goes bad or loses her mind, or is she just acting? Because remember, people do say that she's in the Christmas special. I've pointed out that she's the ongoing companion in the Titan Comics 12th Doctor series, which continues well into next year. I don't think they would have had her in that unless she was ongoing. Or would they? I don't know. So, it goes without saying that Dark Water and Death in Heaven are probably, aside from Deep Breath at the start of the series, the two most I-need-to-see-it-now episodes for fans all over the world. And fully aware that many of you out there might not subscribe to Doctor Who magazine or have the latest issue in your hands as you listen to this, I thought it might be fun to look at the episode preview for Dark Water and Death in Heaven. And obviously it's non-spoilery, and basically I want to run through it and throw in my own comments as we go through. So are you ready? Do you want to know a little more about Dark Water and Death in Heaven? I think you might. Okay, this preview is by Benjamin Cook. Welcome to the Underworld, also known as the Nethersphere, or the Promised Land. It's where you go when you die. Quote, the idea of this two-parter, explains showrunner and writer of this season finale Stephen Moffat, was to keep kicking people out of the comfort zone. You think you know how Doctor Who is going to work? Well, it's not going to this time. Bets are off. End quote. In something of a first for Doctor Who, this episode tells the story of what happens to us when we die. It's a biggie. Quote, so long as we stay inside sci-fi territory, says Stephen, it doesn't bother me. You know, if you meet a god in Doctor Who, that it's going to turn out to be something more, shall we say. Everything tends to be accounted for scientifically. And I say scientifically in the most enormous flashing inverted commas that have ever been attempted. But it has to have some sort of rational, again with those inverted commas, explanation. That's the style of the show. We can't have the supernatural. Or can we? We use all the vocabulary and visual grammar of horror and the supernatural all the time. Right now, we're planning a ghost story for next year. And we use the iconography of it. But how far can we push that? How far beyond? End quote. Now, I'll just jump in here and point out something interesting. Stephen Moffat's talking about setting up a ghost story for next series. It sounds like he's going to be around next series as showrunner. Unless he's setting up some stories now for some other showrunner to work on, or maybe he's working in tandem with another showrunner we haven't met yet. That's interesting. I think that might be a bit of a clue that maybe Stephen won't be going at Christmas. Maybe he'll be around next year for next series, Series 9. And maybe that'll be his last series. Who knows? I think that is a clue, though. Okay, back to the article. Death, as depicted in Dark Water and Death in Heaven, is in turns shocking, uncompromising, gruesome, and surprisingly grown up. Quote, yeah, it's a real-life gruesome as opposed to a game. It's awful, isn't it? End quote. He laughs. Quote, it's Doctor Who's job to push these things further than the show usually goes. We misremember old Doctor Who as being sweet, cuddly, and maybe even a bit camp. But at the time, at least, when I was a kid, it was unquestionably the bad boy of children's TV. All the other children's shows were wholesome shows for nice people, whereas Doctor Who was the show in which the innocent were tortured to death in the first 5 minutes. It's always been like that. It's a proper scary and at times quite nasty show, alongside the huge amount of charm. For this two-parter, I suppose I was looking for an adult chill. And why not? I must have done every childhood fear there is. End quote. And that's quite an interesting thing for Moffat to be saying there, that he's looking for an adult chill. I wonder what he's playing with there. I guess there's the theme of death. I guess that can bother quite a few adults. People of all ages, really. I wonder if that's what it is. Anyway, back to the article. The show's last two-parter was 2011's The Rebel Flesh, The Almost People. So, it's been a while. Quote, I've always said that we'd do another two-parter if we ever had a story to justify it, insists Stephen. But it hasn't quite worked out that way, so I thought, okay, it's time to get back to those. I don't know, there's something about Peter's Doctor that it suits. It's the way he handles a scene, the way he presides over an episode. You want the scene to run a bit longer. I don't know why that is, the gravity of Capaldi? I fancied a big, old, movie-length story with a cliffhanger right in the middle. Yeah, it felt right. End quote. And I'm quite thrilled with that Moffat quote there for one reason, and it's that he acknowledges that, you know, they've only wanted to do another two-parter if they can, you know, see a way to justify it. Because I think that Rebel Flesh and Almost People two-parter really didn't justify it. I think, in fact, several two-parters through Doctor Who's run since 2005 really haven't justified being two-parters. Some have. I mean, you think of the Family of Blood episodes, for example, and that was absolutely worth a two-parter. But things like Daleks in Manhattan and, you know, as I mentioned, the Rebel Flesh and Almost People, yeah, they did hit somewhere. You got to the second episode and it was a bit like, we're really stretching things out here, aren't we, to fill in time? Because maybe it was more than one episode, but it wasn't quite two episodes. Anyway, I'll get back to this article. Ah, the power of a cliffhanger. Quote, I'm not absolutely sure what that power is, but I know I like writing them. I know my sons get exasperated when Doctor Who ends on a cliffhanger. They tell me, let's have it all this week. And I do sort of understand that. You don't normally, when you write a movie-length thing, decide to stop in the middle and have everybody talk about it for a week. My great fear with two-parters is that sometimes the second half can suffer a bit. My thing about cliffhangers is it has to be a moment that changes the way you're looking at it. It has to launch a completely different and hopefully unexpected phase of the story. It's not just a movie cut in half. End quote. So that's quite cool. That's Moffat saying exactly what I just said about, you know, how the second half of two-parters has often been a bit pants. Back to the article. But it has the scale of a movie for sure, complete with an impressive appropriation of an iconic London location and the return of an old foe. Quote, I really wanted to do a Cyberman story, explained Stephen, because they were always my favourites when I was a kid, and I was quite surprised that one way or another I'd never used them in one of my own scripts apart from as supporting characters. I'd started rather dangerously to turn them into a bit of a joke at times. They're thrown away for a bit of a gag at the beginning of A Good Man Goes to War in 2011, so I wanted to do a proper scary one. I always think of the Cybermen as fantastic when they're just about to arrive, less good when they turn up. When they finally get out of the tombs in Tomb of the Cybermen, 1967, they have a bit of a meeting, and then they climb back in. You can't sustain long scenes with them because of the blank faces and so on, but I do love them. They're fantastic. I love the Tomb of the Cybermen. I think it's glorious. End quote. I've got a lot of empathy for Stephen here because growing up, the Cybermen were always my favourite monsters, and in a very, very similar way, I've often felt the anticipation coming up to a Cyberman, so you're like, oh, it's the Cybermen, Cybermen are back. But then when they get on screen, it's like, oh, yeah, Cybermen are back. But I still love them. It's interesting. I've just always liked the concept of the characters and how the Cybermen evolved from human-like people on Mondas, replacing themselves cybernetically, you know, a warning for the future of Earth and, you know, doing too much with cybernetics, and what they became in later seasons. But yeah, often when you do watch a Cyberman story, it is a letdown, even though you love what they are and you're looking forward to it very much. Yeah, I get Moffat here. I totally get this. Back to the article. When Stephen was writing this year's season finale, several of Peter Capaldi's episodes had been recorded already. Quote, yes, because that's the kind of schedule I write on. End quote. How did that inform Stephen's writing of the finale? Quote, it did influence me hugely. Both Peter and Jenna come across on screen, and frankly in real life, as very, very bright. It would be hard to use Jenna just as a striking, lovely girl who's going to go out and be feisty because there's something darker and much more complicated about her. You can imagine her going to quite dark places. And there's something about the combination of the two of them you think, they probably have quite high-flown arguments. In terms of the Doctor and Companion, we've done the fairy tale version, we've done the romantic version, but this is the real-life version. What would it actually be like in real life if an intelligent, off-center girl happened to meet a much older, to say the least, dangerous man who whisked her away and took her to some terrible places? What would that turn you into? I don't think that would necessarily improve you. It would improve you in some ways, but she's never going to comfortably fit back into the boring world. This is a trickier version of the Doctor and a trickier version of the Companion. These two episodes is where that comes to a head. The Doctor and Clara are as heroic and charming and lovable as the Doctor and his Companion have ever been, but they do things that make you uncomfortable at times. You can still like them, even though they do things that are a bit, wow, that's really not good. You're really not supposed to do that. They're not goody two-shoes, either of them. End quote. Well, I'm not too sure what to say to that, because it seems to suggest that the Doctor and Clara are still a team and still happy and, you know, working together. Obviously, it does suggest they do some other stuff as well, but it's not quite pointing to Clara's fall, you know, some sort of Greek tragedy for Clara, but maybe that's just Moffat trying to throw us off the scent. I find those words about Clara and the Doctor intriguing. I particularly find intriguing where he does say that, you know, this is the real-life Doctor and Companion, because we've done the boyfriend and we've done the fairy tale. And that's possibly what some people are disliking about this current series, that it does go back to Coal Hill School all the time, and it does have school kids in it, and we do see Clara and Danny, you know, having disastrous dates with each other, and that's turning some people off, that's making some people think it's soap opera. But here I think we can see it's really part of Stephen Moffat's plan for the series, to be trying to project a real-life doctor and companion, and a real-life companion and what her relationship might be like. So I think we can see that that's very deliberate, and not deliberate as in, oh, let's make this a soap opera, but as in, oh, let's try and do something different with the dynamic here between doctor and companion and boyfriend. I might think on that some more. Back to the article. Although Stephen had this series arc planned from the start, quote, otherwise you don't know what you're building for, end quote, he admits that it's good to surprise yourself when you get to the end. You still should be doing some things you didn't expect to do. That makes it more exciting. These episodes are even more surprising than usual and boast the brilliant Michelle Gomez as a brand new villain. Well, she's popped up a few times in this series already, called the Gatekeeper of the Nethersphere, or Missy for short. Quote, this is one of those rare occasions where I can grab the credit all for myself, says Stephen. We were casting another female role, I can't say which one, otherwise that person will know they were second choice, and I was still pondering how to write the gatekeeper, and I looked at the list for the other part, and I went, oh no, Michelle, that's who should be playing the gatekeeper. But at that point, we'd already offered Michelle the other character, and she turned it down. I was wondering why. Did she hate Doctor Who? Then, out of the blue, she wrote to me saying she was absolutely gutted to have turned down the part. She so wanted to be in Doctor Who, but she was busy, and she'd love to come up and have another go. At this point, I was unusually emphatic. I said, honestly, it's going to be her. We're going to cast Michelle as the gatekeeper. That's 100% the right person to do it. And I wrote the part blatantly for her. She's absolutely wonderful in it. She steals it. End quote. Now, that got me thinking as to what this other role was, and when I think of, you know, big female roles, a bit mysterious, that might have been a Michelle Gomez role, I'm thinking of Tasha Lem. Are you? I'm thinking maybe Michelle was up for Tasha Lem, and, yeah, Stephen doesn't want the actress who played Tasha Lem, who I can't think of off the top of my head, doesn't want her to know that she was second best. Oh, that's sweet of him. Okay, we're almost through this article now. DWM interviews Michelle properly next issue, when we can talk about her episodes more freely. And this is a quote from Michelle. Oh, I think it's just brilliant, she tells DWM. The gatekeeper of the Nethersphere. It's been keeping people guessing, hasn't it? I'm very happy to be part of a lovely, tantalizing mystery. The world that we are living in today is so dark and scary at times. Let's have some fun. Let's get people guessing. Let's not have all the answers to all the questions. Let's not watch everything ahead of time. Let's all do something together as an audience. That's what Doctor Who can do. It carries that wonderful feeling of a fellowship, I guess. No, community, I suppose, is a better word. We're a community, and I'm so thrilled to be part of it. End quote. And that's also the end of the article. There is a little box here that talks about the two episodes in a nutshell, and it says, in the mysterious world of the Nethersphere, plans have been drawn. Old friends and old enemies maneuver around the Doctor, and an impossible choice is looming over him. Death is not an end, promises the organization known as 3W. So that's a bit intriguing. 3W, I don't think we've even heard that name before. Is 3W the group behind the Nethersphere? Is it some kind of company or corporation behind it all? That's got me thinking. There's also a quote here from the episode 2. The quote is, the Doctor, this is it, Clara, one of those moments. Clara, what moments? The Doctor, the darkest day, the blackest hour, chin up, shoulders back, let's see what we're made of, you and I. So again, more intrigue. I don't know what that's all about. The preview we saw of the episode appeared to have Clara on the dark side, as it were, and turning on the Doctor, but there's a nice quote, the Doctor and Clara, you know, together, and those comments from Stephen Moffat about them, you know, being a great team and such, have got me thinking, is all as it seems. I'm really hoping that Clara has a great fall. I'm hoping that all of this lying and all of this lead up to what, again, Al on Diddly Dum calls a Greek tragedy is going to happen. I don't want them to wimp out of it. You know, when we're leading up to the final episodes with Amy and Rory, I was hoping they'd be killed off. I was hoping it'd be something just tragic and terrible and that would make people really feel. And in the end, they were just zapped back in time and lived their full lives. And although they never saw the Doctor again, in theory, which was quite silly. You know, he couldn't fly the TARDIS to New York in their time zone. Well, what if he flew the TARDIS to London and they caught a boat over to meet him? But, you know, maybe I'm putting too much facts in the story. I wanted to see Amy and Rory killed. I wanted it to mean something. I wanted fans out there to be gut-punched and just be so sad and just feel it, and because that's drama. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. That's falling in love with a character and then having that character killed off. That's real. And instead, their ending was quite sweet in a way. They both ended up together. They both ended up having long, happy lives. It really wasn't that tragic, aside from not meeting the Doctor ever again. But, yeah, I'd like to see Clara end badly or turn evil or, you know, be locked in some alternate universe or something and just gut punch the audience and have them, you know, feel something. Although, I've got to say, with the way Clara's been all over the place this series, she's lost a lot of fans. You know, not Jenna Coleman herself, I hasten to add, Jenna Coleman's acting has been superb, but the character of Clara has really lost a lot of people with the way she's been behaving like a total peanut all through the series. So now I'm thinking as I sit here, if you did kill her off, would as many people care? You know, maybe they wouldn't. Gosh, it's all coming down to the next 2 weeks, people. And after these two episodes screen, I'll get together with Kate and Lex like we did after the first six episodes, and we'll run through the second lot of six, and we'll see what we all thought of it, and we'll have a discussion about the series. And then, gosh, we're looking forward to December 25 and the Christmas special. It's just such a great time to be a Doctor Who fan, isn't it? This is a magical time of year. Okay, I'll get out of your hair now. For those of you who didn't have Doctor Who magazine and were curious about that episode preview and or my thoughts on it, there it is. What do you think? Why not write in to me before next episode screens, or wait until next episode screens and then tell me? I'm super keen to hear what you Whovians are thinking of things out there. Get in touch with me in all the usual ways. Alright, for the comics fans out there, this week ahead we'll see The 11th Doctor number 4 hitting comic book shelves. This is the ongoing series from Titan Comics, and I've been reviewing the 10th and 11th and 12th Doctor ranges. There's also going to be a 9th Doctor mini-series coming out, I think, in the new year, or maybe quite late this year. So Titan Comics is really doing quite a lot with Doctor Who at the moment. And if you heard me in the last episode where I reviewed the 11th Doctor comic, I actually did make the comment that I was enjoying it more than the 10th Doctor range. And the reason for that was, although there was an ongoing story arc, the Doctor and his new companion, Alice Obifune, were going to different locations in each and every story. In fact, in issue number 3, they were in Mississippi. They were running into Robert Johnson, you know, the old blues man who sold his soul to the devil and all of that good stuff. And so issue 4 here is a continuation on of that story, so we maintain the Jones character, the Davy Jones character, the one who's basically 60s David Bowie in all but name, as a bit of a comedic element in this story. And we run again into August Hart. We first met him, I think it was issue 1, where he was the chief of security at the Rockandy amusement park. And he had met the Doctor and Alice before, and we think, well, how is that possible? Well, in this issue, they meet him, obviously, for the second time, but he's meeting them for the first time, if you get what I mean. It's kind of a River Song kind of thing. It's kind of time going in two different directions. So I found this issue quite interesting, not trying to go into too many spoilers by, you know, mentioning August Hart pops up again and Servu Corp pops up again. We don't tend to learn too much more about Servu Corp, but I think all of this is going somewhere. I think probably the most interesting aspect of this story is the way the Alice character is kind of shaping out. She's been very sad in the first issue and then started adventuring with the Doctor and really seemed to be enjoying it, but here she's not into it. Here we're seeing flashbacks to her youth and we're learning a few more things about her, and she has this sense that she feels like a bit of a stray that the Doctor's picked up as a bit of a project, and in some ways he has. But she doesn't like that, and she actually asks to be taken home. She's not on good terms with him. In fact, watching this concurrently with the current series of Doctor Who, where, you know, Clara has not been getting on tremendously well with the 12th Doctor at times. There are similarities, not exact similarities. It's probably maybe confusing of me to say that, but just in the sense that here we have a companion who's really not into her relationship with the Doctor and actually just wants to go home. There are some similarities, I guess. I did mention the Jones character. He's coming up with lyrics all the way through this tale, and clearly they're a play on Space Oddity. There's this great scene where he's looking out the window of the space station they've landed on, and he says, you know, planet Earth is all small and, well, sort of orange. And Alice has to point out, that's not planet Earth, Jones. And then he starts singing, and I won't sing it, but you can tell the bit of Space Oddity that this is, you know, parodying. He says, not planet Earth is orange, and there's nothing I can rhyme with orange. And then he says, dum-da-dum-da-dum-dum-dum. So it's like, you can tell exactly what he's doing. But that wasn't the funniest part for me. You can call this toilet humor quite literally, because Jones is in the bathroom when he's coming up with this. And I don't know if I should even read this. And he's singing to himself, and I think this toilet knows which way to flow, and I've wiped my bottom very much, we know. And again, I think you can see which parts of Space Oddity that's from. Then he says, Mission Control to Colonel John, please wash your hands, you've touched your bum, can you hear me, Colonel John? And then he thinks to himself, maybe I should make this a bit less toilety. So, look, there's great humour from the Jones character. Alice is off on her own trip, getting a bit, you know, upset with travelling with the Doctor. August Hart, obviously, is a very important character in this whole Servu Corp arc. And the 11th Doctor, as I've always pointed out when reviewing these comics, sounds like the 11th Doctor when you read his dialogue. All the Titan comics, no matter what you might think of individual storylines or what's going on in them, all of them capture each Doctor's voice, whether it's the 10th, 11th, 12th, and hopefully they do it for the 9th too. It's just like hearing Matt Smith in your head when you read this dialogue, so I can't say enough good things about the writing in the Titan comics in general, and in particular this comic. All up, this comic's really setting us up for, I think, more of the Servu Corp storyline. For the first time, it's ending on a cliffhanger where we're going to remain in the same location, obviously, in the next issue. It's not, you know, going from Earth to Rockhandy, from Rockhandy to Mississippi, and from Mississippi to this space station. We're still going to be on this space station in the next episode, and I think really learning a bit more about Servu Corp. And that's a good thing. I think it's an interesting storyline. I think it's bedded in well enough now, and the Doctor has two new companions we've never heard of before. You know, certainly not in the TV series, I should say. It's going places. I'm really enjoying the 11th Doctor range. So big kudos to writer Al Ewing and artist Boo Cook. This is Boo Cook's first issue of the 11th Doctor range. Prior to Boo, it was Simon Fraser, if I recall. And I've got to say, I actually like Boo Cook's art style more than Simon's. They are similar in some ways. When you pick this up, you won't think, oh my god, this looks completely different to the first three issues. But it is different. But there's enough similarities between the two as well. You know, they both tend to exaggerate Matt Smith's look and his long, lean face and his thinness and so on. So it's not jarring that there's a new artist on the comic, but it is different, and I do really like Boo Cook's stuff. So hopefully Boo Cook will be on the comic for a little while. I might even try and get in touch with Boo Cook, see if they'd like to come on the show. Anyway, thinking out loud here. That's the 11th Doctor, issue number 4. The name of the individual episode is Who Done It, and I'm really interested to know who done it, because I think there's a whole lot more we're going to learn in the next issue, and maybe even the one after. There's a lot going on with Serv Corp. Have you been reading these 11th Doctor comics? Do you like them? Why not write in and tell me all about it?
This is M.A. Timber reminding you that for free, full episodes of Doctor Who Dark Journey, news, cast info, and much more, visit us online at amaudiomedia.com.
Cool beans!
Yeah. You know, one of the things with Who Wars and the people who listen to Who Wars is I never quite know where some of you are up to. I certainly know that a lot of you have gone back and have started listening from episode one, which to me is strange because episode one has reviews and news that to me are quite old. But to many of you, it seems, and I can see this from the statistics, you've decided to go back and listen to us from episode one, maybe so you can collect them all like Pokemon. I'm not sure. But it shows me that people don't always listen to Who Wars in the order we produce in, or even in the week that we put the episode out. So I don't know if I say to you now, hey, you may have been listening to the Eric J interviews in the past week, whether some of you will have listened to them or not, or whether you're going to go back to and listen to them at some stage, or whether you have no idea what I'm talking about. But last weekend, it was my great pleasure to sit down with a pro comic book artist called Eric J. I'd been a fan of his for a decade, and we'd spoken a lot in terms of text, you know, emails and online and so on, Facebook even, but never in real life. And we sat down to chat. I thought it would last about an hour, but it lasted in reality over 3 hours. And so rather than put out a 3 hour long podcast, I decided to chop it up into bits. And over the last week, I've played a Star Wars section and a Doctor Who section. Obviously, being a Star Wars and Doctor Who show, that's a pretty obvious thing to do, right? But the bigger section of the interview, the real meat and potatoes of the interview, were questions I'd been asking Eric, which I'd always wanted to ask Eric. And that was about learning to draw and how he got into the industry and, you know, what goes on at comic conventions and things like this. And so there was a large interview that has nothing to do with Star Wars, nothing to do with Doctor Who, that I had up my sleeve and which I'm playing for you all next Wednesday. Now, what I'm going to do is play a little anecdote from that interview here to give you a taste of it. It's quite different to the Star Wars and Doctor Who episodes where I was, you know, asking him, you know, who's your favorite Doctor? You know, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Could you draw this Doctor? Blah, blah, blah. And really starts to tread into some territory where I think if you have friends who are comic book fans or, you know, they're into comic book art, they don't have to be into Doctor Who or Star Wars at all to really get a lot out of this episode that comes up next Wednesday. Anyway, I'll get out of your hair here and play a bit of the interview so you can get a feel for it, and I'll be back after this. Well, you know, at these conventions, you're there at some of them working, you're sitting at a booth, you might be sketching for people. Do you have any stories from cons? They might be like weird fans who have come up, or just other interesting things that have happened while you're sitting there at a booth watching the world go by? Or do you have mostly respectful fans?
You know, I have pretty amazing fans, I have to say. You know, that no one's... Yeah, no, I don't really have any bad stories, to be honest with you. I mean, like, the bad stories generally are like, you know, you find a lot of people don't like to do portfolio reviews. And I get it, you know what I mean? Having been the person trying to get reviews, you know, you're coming in and you're nervous and you don't quite know what you want, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. If you want a critique or if you want a job, you know what I mean? Like, obviously the thing you want is a job, but...
So for people unfamiliar with this is people coming in with their portfolio and showing it to a publisher, maybe, or...
Publisher, artist, editor, yeah, mm-hmm. And trying... If they're showing their portfolio to me, you know, they're coming to me to get tips, you know what I mean? Like a critique, you know what I mean? Because there's no way I can give them a job. but you know, we do, you know, we artists will do that, you know what I mean? I kind of famously got a review done by Neil Adams, and I you know, friends of mine, you know, we all sit around talking about, like, you know, the horror stories of a Neil Adams, you know, portfolio review.
He's pretty brutal, is he?
Oh, he is horribly brutal. But the thing is he's good. It's good. You know what I mean? You have to be made of sterner stuff, though, you know, to take it. Hmm. But if you can, it's absolutely what you need, you know? I remember I was standing in line to get a portfolio review from Neil 1 year. And he did about 3 reviews before he finally got to me. And I could hear every one of them, you know?
Yeah.
And I step up to him and I plop my portfolio down in front of him, and he goes, "Okay, you heard all of those. Are you sure you want to do this?"
And was he saying the same stuff to each of them, or was he saying unique stuff to each?
No. And that's the thing. You go to a lot of people and, you know, there's a lot of sort of generic advice, you know what I mean? Like, and because it's generic, don't get me wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean it's not applicable, you know? It's just that it's sort of the same stuff that you hear all over, you know, work on your storytelling, work on your anatomy, work on your dynamism, you know, blah, blah, blah. But Neil actually took the time, you know, for every single person that was, you know, in front of him to actually look at the work and take things and specifically point out things that they needed to work on. And not just like say, like, you need to work on this, but give an example of like how they might work on it. I mean, that's like, that's why I say, like, yes, he's brutal. He is brutal. And by brutal, I mean that he is, he's the Simon Cowell.
Oh, wow.
Of artists that might review your portfolio, you know, which is not a bad thing. It's, he's telling you the things that you need to hear, whether you want to or not, you know?
Yeah. So you stood your ground. You said, no, I'm going to stay here and hear your critique. What did he have to say?
Oh, he had mostly complimentary things. He told me to work on my folds and the fabric and stuff. He's like, and he like, you know, he puts his arm out and he kind of points to his, the folds in his, he had a long sleeve shirt on, you know, and mm-hmm. he's like, see this? This is poetry, you know? And I'm like, damn, you're right. That is poetry.
All right, so that was myself chatting with Eric J. last weekend about drawing and the creative process. And obviously at that point we're talking about conventions and getting portfolios done by other professional comic book artists. You know, when you're on your way up in the industry and you want other comic book artists to say what they think of your work. I found that a fascinating story, and there's still more of that story to come in the episode we play on Wednesday. So again, like I said in the introduction, if you have friends who are into comic books in general, they don't have to be scared that it's all about Star Wars or Doctor Who if they're not into those things. This is a really general, interesting sort of chat with a pro comic book artist that I think would be really great if you're taking a long drive somewhere, maybe a commute to work, or maybe you're off on vacation somewhere. I think you could just slip this in and just let the hour and a half, whatever it ends up being by the time I finished editing it, roll by, and you'll learn a bit, and I think you'll quite enjoy the conversation. I certainly enjoyed having it, and you'll hear it all, as I say, next Wednesday. Well, that brings us to the end of the 11th Who Wars. Gosh, we've jumped ahead there, haven't we? Especially those two episodes during the week with Eric J. That's 11 episodes up. It'll be 12 next Wednesday when we talk again with Eric, and then 13 by the time we come back next Sunday. I hope you've been enjoying them. The team here certainly has, Lex and Leo and also Kate. And my thanks too to Ryder Waldron for some great listener feedback, and to Yancey Evans for answering my questions on Star Wars Rebels ratings. As I always say, if you have anything to say to the show, you can email it, you can MP3 it, you can tell it to me on Twitter or Facebook. All the details are about to play in the closing credits. And as always, if you have iTunes, please open it up. Give us a rating and a review. Just a one-sentence review. Just something very short, because ratings and reviews will help other people find the show. People just like you. So if you want to help us out and help out your fellow fans, that's something, it would just be amazing if you could do that for us. Thank you so much. I'm Rob Irwin, and I'll talk to you this coming Wednesday, an interview with Eric J.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars, or if Facebook's more your thing, facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.